Everybody, thank you for coming tonight. My name is Julia Mahoney. I'm the Educational Program Administrator for Renew Theaters. Renew manages the Ambler, the County, the Princeton Garden, and the Highway Theaters. So I want to thank you all from our different theaters for joining us. And if you are not a member of one of our theaters, I still want to welcome you as well. We are also partnering with the Majestic Theater in Gettysburg. So I want to give them a little shout out too. Programs like this are possible due to the support of our members, as well as the support of the VESTA Fund, which has given us a grant for our online seminar series, Deep Focus. Before we dive into tonight's program, Paths of Glory, I wanted to mention a couple of events that we have coming up in the next few weeks. Next Tuesday, we will continue our French New Wave series with a seminar on Jean-Luc Godard's Vivre sa vie, and you can find that movie streaming via HBO Max, the Criterion Channel, and Canopy. In 2 weeks from now, we'll have our final talk in our Asian American film series, The Celine Archive. And the director for that movie will actually be present for the talk, which is pretty exciting stuff. To watch that film, you get a free screener when you register for the event. So please check out our Deep Focus website for that. And you can also find any information on past and upcoming talks on our website, deepfocus.film. Most of you are somewhat familiar with our Zoom protocol, so I'll just do a couple of quick reminders. Most of all, we ask that you remain on mute, especially in the beginning when Hannah is talking, and we'll open things up to conversation. If you do have a question, please use the raise hand feature located at the bottom of your screen. And if you are having trouble locating that, just raise your hand and I can also call on you that way. I'll start by moderating the discussion, and then as things get moving a bit, we can get a little more free flowing. Also, the chat feature is enabled, and that tends to be very lively and exciting, especially during Hannah's talks. So please feel free to use that. And I also just want to invite you to turn your cameras on. We realize these Zoom discussions have a little bit more, you know, humanity. It feels like you're talking to other people when you can actually see other people's faces. So it just makes it a little bit nicer for everybody. And it's okay. Like if you're doing your dishes, you're cleaning, you know, that's fine. Just look our way every once in a while. It is my pleasure to introduce Hannah Jack, our speaker for the evening. Hannah is a writer for Turner Classic Movies and has scripted many of the introductions, which you hear if you watch TCM. We are very happy to have Hannah hosting this ongoing classic film series for us month after month, jumping along a variety of genres and decades. So with that, I turn it over to Hannah.
Hey everybody, thank you so much. And I wanna reiterate Julia's invitation. I'm so grateful to those of you who just did this, but we have more than 30 people here and I'd love to see your faces. So even if you're not in the most flattering backdrop, do not worry. It would be great to just see the crowd who's here. And I'm so grateful to you for joining for tonight's talk. This is one of those movies that I think has a lot to say and there's a lot to say about it. And I'm really, really curious to know kind of where we're going to take this conversation and what your reactions to this film were. Oh, it's melting my heart to see so many of you. Thank you for turning your cameras on. I really appreciate that. So actually, while I have you all here, I want to see a quick show of hands because I'm curious. How many people got to see this movie on the big screen? I know it was in the theaters briefly. Amazing. Good. Yeah, I did too. And it was such a treat. And also, I'm curious to know how many people had never seen this movie before coming tonight? Great, okay, cool. Yeah, it's definitely one of those movies that is lesser known and I think deserves to be more seen. And I'm curious to know what you think. I have been, it's great also to see new faces joining. So I'm gonna say what you may know very well, but I if you're just joining for the first time, I tend to mention next month's title. We are amazingly more than a year and a half into this series right now. I do this every month and I'm still pinching myself. And so for next month, I actually teased the title last month, if you were with us. I'm gonna mention it again. Next month we'll be joining on June 7th, that's also a Tuesday at 7:30, to talk about the 1933 landmark movie musical Footlight Parade. That is a movie that kind of broke new ground and showed the world what the movie musical could do. It's a movie that came out of a really, really rich, and I mean that tongue-in-cheek kind of way, period, because it was made during the Depression, but this really, really culturally rich moment in terms of what was going on in Hollywood at the time. And it was just escapism for the Depression era audience in a way that's really powerful. It's also a movie that boasts choreography that still stuns you today by the great Busby Berkeley. It's impossible to watch that movie without being blown away, even by 2022 standards, by his choreography. And I'm so excited that it's going to be on the big screen. So if you can catch Busby Berkeley on the big screen, run. Julia, maybe you have those dates, do you? You can pull them up. I'll say another word about it if you have. Yeah. And the reason I mentioned it actually last month was because I wanted to give you a heads up. There are two things that are relevant. If you watch Turner Classic Movies, there are kind of two tie-ins. One is that this month, on Monday nights, TCM is presenting the works of Busby Berkeley. And I wrote all the introductions to those movies. So if you get a chance to tune in Monday nights this month, you can see all of the great Busby Berkeley choreography and direction in all these musicals, which will give you some context for Footlight Parade. And then the other thing is that Footlight Parade, it requires a little bit of a red flag, because there is one number that comes very late in the film where a white actress is made up and performing in a racist stereotyped caricature of a Chinese woman. And that shows up in a musical number at the end of the film. And it's not something that we're going to gloss over and pretend isn't there. It's important to talk about. It's important to contextualize what Hollywood was willing to do at that time. And it ties into another thing that's on Turner Classic Movies this month, which is that TCM has been Thursday nights spotlighting the career and films of Anna Mae Wong, who was the first Chinese American movie star. So every Thursday in May, you can catch Anna Mae Wong's pioneering movies. And it, as part of that, there's a documentary that aired once. It's going to be airing again on May 20th on Turner Classic Movies, called Yellow Face, which is a history of this practice, this very uncomfortable and very racist practice in Hollywood history, even into the present, of having white actors play Asian characters. So if you have a chance to catch that documentary, that will also give context for this moment in Footlight Parade. That's why I'm mentioning it well ahead of time and again tonight, so that you may have a chance to catch some of this other stuff. But if not, don't worry, we'll be talking about it then. That said, there is so much to love about Footlight Parade. It is still widely regarded as a masterpiece, and I do hope you'll check it out. It is available to stream and rent. Julia, what were there dates for in the theater?
Yes, yep. So it's playing on Thursday, June 2nd at the County, and then Wednesday, June 8th at the Ambler and the Garden. So people can catch it on the big screen about a week before your talk or the day after with their new thoughts bubbling in their brains.
That's great. Please do, if you can, see Busby Berkeley choreography up on that big screen. That will be something special. So anyhow, I'm going to talk a little bit about Paths of Glory, something totally different from Footlight Parade, and then we'll open it up for discussion. So I'm going to attempt here to share my screen. Let's see if I can do it gracefully. Here we go. And I'll give you some visuals as we're talking. So does everybody see Kirk Douglas? Yes, great. So the reason I chose this film for this month was also a TCM tie-in. Every May, Turner Classic Movies does a three-day marathon of war movies for Memorial Day weekend. And, tragically, it's timely as well, as the world is engaged in war currently. There's probably a lot to say about this movie in this current moment too. And it's a genre we haven't tapped into in this series. We have not talked about a war movie yet. And this one, I would argue, is first an anti-war movie. I think that's pretty clear. And then it's also, I think it's like half war movie and half courtroom drama. So it kind of like straddles these two genres in kind of an interesting way too. And of course, it's a movie that brings in some key players we haven't talked about yet in this series. And one of them is the film's director, Stanley Kubrick. Stanley Kubrick, this was made very, very early on in his career. So if this didn't feel like the kind of movie you think of when you think Stanley Kubrick, it was really at the start of his remarkable career. He had only, he made only 13 movies. I'll give you the dates of his career. Think about this, only 13 movies between 1953 and 1999. He only made 13 feature films. This was number four. So early on, he kind of honed his interest in photography as a still photographer and began directing newsreel, like short newsreel documentaries before he kind of cobbled together his first feature film. His first two movies, this is what he made before Paths of Glory. His first two movies here, Fear and Desire and Killer's Kiss, were made in the early 1950s on a very low budget with non-professional actors. And this was how Stanley Kubrick kind of got his start. And then he graduated to slightly more professional, impressive status with a film noir called The Killing in 1956, which starred a movie star, a real movie star in this one, Sterling Hayden, about a racetrack heist. So this is all he had done before Paths of Glory. And The Killing united him for the first time with a man who would become his producing partner over the next four films, James Harris. And together, and with James Harris was able to kind of handle the business side of things, and Kubrick was able to focus on the artistic side of things. And they set out, after they first like kind of made a little splash with The Killing in 1956, they wanted to make an even more kind of, you know, acceptable, prestigious picture with a bigger, you know, budget, with more star power. And they were trying to think of what to do. And they thought, oh, it would be great to make a war movie, an anti-war movie specifically. And they were trying to think of what story to tell. Kubrick, if you look at his movies, almost always adapted a story by somebody else, always a novel or a short story or something like that. And he remembered having read this book when he was younger called Paths of Glory. Paths of Glory was published in 1935, written by a man named Humphrey Cobb. And it was, Cobb got the idea when he read a New York Times article in 1934 about these French families, five French families who had sued the army in France because their relatives had been executed during World War I for failing to follow orders. This happened in 1915. The families, two decades later, were suing the French army. The courts agreed these men were unfairly executed, but they didn't give the families any kind of reparations. And that outraged Humphrey Cobb when he read this article about it. And so he fictionalized the story. It was a real story though. He fictionalized it and wrote Paths of Glory, gets published in 1935. Immediately, it's adapted for not the big screen, but for the stage by a man named Sidney Howard. And he was he went on to be the main screenwriter on Gone with the Wind. But he wrote this play, Paths of Glory, and it was on Broadway, and it was not a hit. And I'm going to read this quote from a review, because I think it's interesting. Brooks Atkinson, who was the New York Times theater critic, saw the play and said, "Someday the screen will seize this ghastly tale and make a work of art from it." Well, that day didn't happen until more than 20 years later. And that's when Stanley Kubrick remembered the book and decided to adapt it for the big screen. It had never been brought to the screen before. And they realized, Kubrick and his producing partner, James Harris, realized that they needed to start by casting Colonel Dax. That was like step one, was who are we gonna get to star in this movie? And they had a lot of actors who they thought about, including James Mason and Richard Burton. A lot of agents though, didn't want their clients to even consider the script because they thought it was depressing. And they did not think that this was going to be a box office hit in any way. One actor who was very interested, regardless, was Gregory Peck. But he didn't turn out to be available in the time that they were ready to do this. So that's, I think that's interesting to think about what this movie would have looked like with Gregory Peck as Colonel Dax. Could have worked. But then simultaneously, Kubrick really actually wanted Kirk Douglas. And Kirk Douglas saw that movie he had just made, The Killing, and was really impressed with Stanley Kubrick and wanted to meet him. So he arranged a meeting and said, what do you have in the works? And Kubrick handed him the script that they had developed so far for Paths of Glory. And Kirk Douglas was really interested. And he had a production company that he had recently formed and was able to kind of serve as producer and star. And in his position, he was able to broker a deal that got the movie financed by United Artists. United Artists had two requirements. One was the movie had to be made on a very small budget. It was made for under $1 million, which comparatively speaking is not that big. And it had to be shot in Europe where everything could be done cheaper. So it was filmed outside of Munich. Everything was done in Germany, which is interesting because it actually takes place in France on the French side of the war, but it was filmed in Germany. So Kirk Douglas, this is the other key player we haven't talked about yet in this series. Here's where he was at this point in his career. Stanley Kubrick was really just getting started. Kirk Douglas was a bona fide movie star. He was one of the biggest stars of the post-war era in Hollywood. And his career didn't start until the post-war era. He didn't make his film debut until 1946. He started out acting on the stage and was on Broadway and owed his movie career to his former classmate from drama school, a woman named Betty Bacall, who became famous as Lauren Bacall. They were in drama school together, and Lauren Bacall became famous earlier in the 1940s. And when Warner Brothers producer Hal Wallace was looking for talent, she said, you gotta go check out this play. My friend, whose name is Kirk Douglas, is in it, go see it. And she sent this big Hollywood producer to go see him. And that's what impressed Hal Wallace and led to Kirk Douglas's debut in movies. He made his debut in 1946 in this great film noir, The Strange Love of Martha Ivers. He was a very non-Kirk Douglas type in that movie. He started out playing this like spineless, alcoholic third, you know, wheel of a love triangle kind of guy. But he very quickly established himself as the Kirk Douglas we think of, who was this macho, high energy, you know, tough guy in a lot of movies. These are just some of the movies that he made before Paths of Glory. So you have Out of the Past, which was, you know, his second year in Hollywood. He's co-starring in this landmark film noir. Ace in the Hole, which is a brilliant Billy Wilder movie about the newspaper business. The Bad and the Beautiful, which is one of the great Hollywood movies about Hollywood, earned Kirk Douglas an Oscar nomination. And then right before Paths of Glory, he starred as Vincent Van Gogh in Lust for Life, which is one of his most famous roles, and earned him another Oscar nomination. So this is where he was. Again, Kubrick didn't have nearly the clout at this point that Kirk Douglas had. So getting Kirk Douglas on board was a huge feather in their cap. Both men were very strong visionaries. And so you can imagine that there were moments where they're, you know, there were some clashes because their visions were both so strong, but they did make this movie in fairly peaceable terms. But they disagreed on one point in particular, which was the ending of the film. At one point, Kubrick actually decided to have the script rewritten to have a happy ending. And Kirk Douglas said, "Are you crazy? This is not the script you gave me at the beginning. What are you talking about? This movie cannot end with these men being, you know, let off the hook." So that's kind of the biggest point of contention. And of course, Kirk Douglas got his way. The movie itself, as predicted by all these agents, was not a huge box office hit by any means, but it was a favorite of the critics. And Kirk Douglas knew that Stanley Kubrick had directed him in one of his really best performances. And so when the time came, just 3 years later, where Kirk Douglas was starring in the movie Spartacus, another one of his biggest hits, and he decided to replace his director, Anthony Mann, he replaced him with Stanley Kubrick. So once again, they teamed up 3 years later for what was Kubrick's next movie after Paths of Glory, which was Spartacus. Now in that movie, Kubrick, like I said, was brought in to replace another director. Well, by the time he arrived on the set, basically all of the big decisions had been made. And that really, really irked Stanley Kubrick. He did not like coming in and having almost no creative control. Spartacus was a Kirk Douglas production. And what resulted from that movie in Kubrick's career was that, A, it was his first big box office hit, which allowed him financially to move out of the United States and Hollywood and relocate himself to be in England. And B, it taught Stanley Kubrick that never again was he going to be a director for hire. He was never going to take a job that he didn't have control over. And so if you look at the rest of his career, and this is the rest of his career, this is all the other movies he made after Spartacus, all eight of them, he was in charge fully. So Lolita, he made after Spartacus, that was the last time he worked with that producing partner, James Harris. From Dr. Strangelove on, and these are in chronological order here, Stanley Kubrick was producer, director, and writer, and he took his sweet time to make the movies that he wanted to make. Famously was absolutely as meticulous as you could get and really took charge of his own career in a way that other directors of that era didn't, by and large. And so he created these really indelible films that you know, many of them are still regarded as masterpieces. I will say that two more things about his career, and we can talk about if you've seen other movies, like what you did see that's kind of like a Kubrick picture in Paths of Glory. One thing is that four of those 13 movies happen to be war films, specifically anti-war films, starting with that first one, Fear and Desire, Paths of Glory, Dr. Strangelove, and Full Metal Jacket. These are all really centered in wars. And the other thing is that Stanley Kubrick had a real knack for casting. And that's where I'll kind of end my talk here, is just to point out some of the incredible figures who are in this cast. It's a really rich cast in the sense that it's not a lot of familiar faces, but they have real personalities and I think add a lot to this, to the dynamic in this movie. So these are the three, obviously the three prisoners. You have, I'll go left to right, Ralph Meeker, who was a character actor. This was really his most famous role. His only other kind of big lead role was in a film noir called Kiss Me Deadly, which you see under there. Then you have Joe Turkel as Private Arnault. And he actually, his more famous roles came later. He's still alive, actually. His more famous roles came as a much older actor. Again, when he teamed up with Stanley Kubrick in 1980 in The Shining, he plays Lloyd the bartender in The Shining. And he also was if you've seen Blade Runner, he's the corporate tycoon who creates the replicants. He has a much older man too. Those are kind of his two other more famous roles. Then you have this wackadoo Timothy Carey as Private Farrell. And he had also worked with Stanley Kubrick once before. In the picture you see on the bottom right there, that's in that movie, The Killing, the one that he made right before Paths of Glory. He was the killer. On Paths of Glory, he turned out to be a real loose cannon. He was a scene stealer, which I'm sure is not a stretch to imagine when you think about his performance in this movie. He often disrupted take after take because he had to, you know, work in something that no one was ready for. And he also had to be fired ultimately from the production because he got into a bit of trouble with the police. He faked his own kidnapping while the movie was being made. And the police found him on the side of a highway and had to call in the producer and say, is this some kind of publicity stunt for the movie? And it was not, obviously. It was Timothy Carey doing something weird. And he wouldn't cooperate enough to go back to the set. So they fired him. The result was that the movie wasn't finished yet. And there's a scene where, if you can remember the scene where the prisoners are in the cell and his character is, you know, praying and confessing to the priest, but you only see him from the back. That's not him, that's a double. And the other part of the film that was not done yet was that the entire battle sequence hadn't been shot. That was saved for the end because they had to construct the battlefield and rig it with all the explosives. That was the most involved set, and they waited till the end. So if you were wondering why these three men who were accused of cowardice don't actually show up in the battle at all, it's because they couldn't, Timothy Gary was fired, so they couldn't have him in the battle. And if you saw the other two without him, it would probably raise some questions as to where was this other one. So it's, you know, it was an accident that I actually think ends up being kind of an interesting choice, but it was not really their choice. The other great faces in the crowd here include some movie veterans, no one more veteran than Adolf Manjou as the major general. This was the end of Adolf Manjou's remarkable career. He only made like two or three movies after this. This was 1957. His film debut came in 1914. So he was in the movies since the early days of the silent era in films directed by Charlie Chaplin and Joseph von Sternberg. He was in the original A Star is Born. He earned an Oscar nomination for originating the role that Cary Grant went on to play in The Front Page, remade as His Girl Friday, which we talked about if you were with us for that talk. So his career was long and consistent in Hollywood. And then you have George McCready on the right there, who is, of course, the villainous character here. And that was his career, more or less. He was the polished villain in one movie after the next, most famously as Rita Hayworth's husband in Gilda, which came about a decade before Paths of Glory. And yes, the scar is real. He was in a car accident in college, and that was the result, and that just added to his image. And I'll end with these two characters as well. You have the major who is just so deliciously smarmy in this role. And he became more famous co-starring on television on The $6 Million Man a little bit later in his career. That was his other kind of famous role. Richard Anderson is the actor. And then while Stanley Kubrick didn't get a huge box office hit out of this movie, he did get really the greatest reward, which was that this was the movie that introduced him to his third wife. The woman who sings at the very end of the film, really the only female character in this movie, was billed as Susan Christian. She was a German actress. I mean, I mentioned that this was made in Germany. He found her on German television. She was the daughter of German actors and singers, and he brought her to the set to kind of interview her. And by all accounts, it was love at first sight. And she got the part, and they got married almost immediately after the film was done. She became Christiana Kubrick, and they were married until his death in 1999. It was a very happy marriage. And their marriage and his success actually enabled her to quit acting and focus on what she really loved, which was painting. And later in Stanley Kubrick's movies, her paintings adorn the walls of many sets in his films. So that was kind of the beginning of a really special chapter of his life. So that's where I'm gonna stop. I know there's a lot to say about this movie that has nothing to do with the making of it, has much more to do with what you're seeing in it, the performances, maybe some of the camera work, some of what this movie is talking about. Please, I'm gonna stop my screen share here, and I would love to hear your thoughts. And I don't know if there were things that came up in the chat, but I can catch up on that as well. You can go ahead and use the raise hand feature if you have anything that you wanted to share, or sorry, I'm just gonna shut this. Anything that surprised you about this movie specifically or felt relevant maybe or dated?
There is one thing that came up in the chat that a couple people were commenting on. Remy said that she thinks that it actually works better without showing the three soldiers during the battle because it enforces how randomly they were chosen.
Absolutely, that's such a great point. Yeah, and the absurdity of it. Who are these men? You didn't even see them really before. Absolutely. Was there any scene that really jumped out at you, it struck you more than the others? Don't be shy, jump in.
Daniel.
Yeah, I mean, as far as scenes that struck me, I don't know. I was just thinking, it's just as a comment, I liked how a lot of, it's still kind of half-baked, but it was interesting. And you mentioned absurdity, I guess, like the sets, and I guess maybe the, it was just, to me, it was like kind of claustrophobic in ways, in like the paths. It was ordered in a lot of ways, but there's something about the sets and like the largeness of the estate that they were in, and kind of the absurdity of, there's something that I had been thinking about as far as the juxtaposition of just being like in a foxhole, so to say, but then also in these hugely high ceilinged spaces. There's anything there that, as far as that, if there's anything you can speak to with the setting.
Yeah, so. I mean, that, well, it was all on these, I mean, the trenches were created, obviously, but the palace was real. The juxtaposition is exactly, as you're saying, is so emphasizes, I think, the injustice of it all. Like, here are these, you know, generals who don't have to be on the battlefield passing judgment on all of these men who do and have to be in it. And the, you know, how the visual of the set really, I mean, I'm very struck by that too, that you're in this beautiful, beautiful room. It's spacious and everything. And then what the reality of where the men are is so different. But anyway, I see a lot of hands if anyone else wants to chime in about that or anything. Yeah.
William?
Yeah, I just had two Kubrick thoughts. Thinking about his later movies, it's interesting to hear that he added a happy ending onto this, because Clockwork Orange, there's a story that the author Anthony Burgess, there was a last chapter that is kind of a happy ending to that didn't make it into, I want to say, the British or the American, I forget the copy, but whatever copy Kubrick read didn't have the last chapter in it, which was the happy ending, which did not make it into the movie. And I've read that he refused to consider including that happy ending in the movie Clockwork Orange. The other thought, and it's been a long time since I've seen this, is that I think Full Metal Jacket also ends with a song, like a Mickey Mouse song at the end of this horrible war sequence. So I was really struck by the moment of connection between these French soldiers and the German woman. You really think that scene is gonna go a different way. But then it becomes this kind of moment of human connection, even though they're harassing this woman, because they all know the same melody and are able to sing along with it. So yeah, just two thoughts. One, Kubrick seems to have changed some of his feelings about happy endings. And the other is that something about ending a war movie with music seems to have appealed to him.
Yeah, absolutely. Such good points. That last moment, I mean, you could have just so easily ended it with the execution. But it extends, right? It takes us into this other moment. And really, we never see the German enemy, ever, except for this one German woman who is not going to be someone they're fighting in the trenches. It's somebody who's totally, you know, separate from that, who just represents the country. And how this song is, you know, something that they have, it brings, I mean, I read it as it bringing out their humanity, their shared humanity, because they're singing the same song. They're all moved by the same song. The moment when Kubrick and his future wife actually met and discussed this character, she was very apprehensive, because she said, well, you know, I'm not really a singer. And he said, well, no, this character is not a singer. She's not a professional singer. She's being dragged on stage and has to sing something. And what would somebody who is in that position sing? And she was empowered to choose the song. So she gave it some thought and came up with the song that she sings, which she likened to the American war tune, When Johnny Comes Marching Home Again. It's a song that everyone would have known and would have been kind of a war song, that a folk song that people who weren't singers would have been able to join in and sing. So she chose that, which is an interesting, I think, choice as well.
Thomas.
Yeah, I mean, my God, so much in this film. But I mean, the political context of this film is fascinating. I mean, first of all, it being made in 1957 in the height of the Cold War, in the height of the communist scare, not a lot of people were really making anti-war films or, you know, really those who were talking anti-war were looked at very askance in that climate. So for Kubrick, of course, to make it, but then for Kirk Douglas to, you know, a star of his stature to make this blatant an anti-war film in 1957, is absolutely incredible and fascinating. And you know, you talk about that set, the set piece, and you know, it not only, of course, you know, draws the context or the juxtaposition within the film between those who the general and his staff who are living this life of luxury while those actually fighting the war and facing the enemy are living in these horrible trenches, but also I think is a very strong political statement about people who make war and make it from the sidelines, and they're the ones who are directing the war, who initiated, who get it going, and that's where at least one of the places where the relevance today just remains, where you have people in Moscow, making a war in the Ukraine, but they're miles away and they've got, they are living in the Kremlin or wherever and have nothing, no real connection with those people on the ground. And I think that's an incredible political statement to make at that time, and is still an incredible political statement today.
Absolutely. Yeah, you've made so many great points. All four of the Stanley Kubrick movies that were about war were anti-war movies made at various points in his career. Dr. Strangelove, coming in the 60s, and then Full Metal Jacket being about the Vietnam War. But yeah, absolutely. In 1957, what is funny to me too is that the fact that the big Oscar winner of 1957 was The Bridge on the River Kwai, which is also an anti-war movie. It's a movie about the absolute folly and purposelessness of war, but it's told in a very different way. It's not gritty, it's not black and white, it's not, it's got the kind of pomp and circumstance of, war in a very different way, but that for whatever reason was more palatable for audiences in 1957. This was a much different tone, I think. And Kirk Douglas, you mentioned as being brave in this, that was a hallmark of his career, is that he was brave in a way that a lot of his contemporaries weren't. And famously with Spartacus, ended the blacklist in Hollywood that had been such a problem, a detriment to so many people's careers, when he stood up and said, no, we're crediting screenwriter Dalton Trumbo on this movie. And that was it. That was the beginning of the end for the Hollywood blacklist. And that was through his courage too. But it was also through the clout that he had at this point in his career too. That's such a great point, yeah.
Janet.
I have two points, and I'll make them in sequence. If you wanna comment afterwards, great. But I saw in the chat, someone talked about the shots inside the trenches, and they were going this way, following people that way. And I noticed when I was watching the movie, how many shots were tracking what I'll call then horizontally. They kept going back and forth, and it was very noticeable in the trial. And also they were behind the judges, which was very strange. But I also saw that right to left and other things before I even got to the trial. So I kind of wish I hadn't noticed it. Like, I'd rather not be watching shots in a movie. I'd like be so involved that I didn't notice that. Or maybe it says something about the shots themselves that they distracted me. And the other point is, these are supposed to be French soldiers. And other than maybe the way they saluted and they snapped their heels together, they were just a bunch of American GIs. And America doesn't make any never made any effort that I can recall to make a movie that was consistently of one culture. And there might have somebody who speaks with a British accent and then a lot of people from Brooklyn. It doesn't make any difference, as opposed to like the British who try to do things authentically, or we'll go get someone with the correct accent. So that's it. Those are my two
comments. Excellent points. And there's a lot to say about both. But in terms of the shots, that was Kubrick very much being deliberate about where his camera was going to be placed and kind of what the pace of that scene would be. I read an interpretation of that exact moment that you talk about in the trial. How many people, I mean, I felt this way, but maybe you did too. When Kirk Douglas is defending these poor men, you just want a close-up on his face, right? Don't you want to like see him deliver his speech? But Kubrick doesn't give us that. And I read an interpretation of that, which I love, that it just shows us how much his pleas are falling on deaf ears. This is not going to resonate in this courtroom. It's just not, you're not going to get any kind of sense that this is someone who's in control of the moment, who is, you know, front and center, who everyone's paying attention to. Instead, we're going to see it, you know, behind other people's heads, and it's not going to sink in that way. And so I think if you go back and approach some of the other scenes where the camera is doing that, and kind of think what could Kubrick have been saying with that, it was always very deliberate. And the other point that you made about the accents was also a deliberate choice on their part. Of course, it is in keeping with what Hollywood did so often, which is to put American voices in whatever, you know, culture we're in. But the producer, James Harris, actually said that that was very consciously a choice on their part, because they saw it as being, if you got like a French novel, but you're reading it and you don't read French, you're reading an American or an English translation. And so they viewed this movie as being a French story just in an English slash Americanized translation, where that was their view on that particular choice. But yeah, it's a great points.
How do you raise your hand?
That's all right, Edward, you can go anyway.
Go?
But it,
you mean go or speak?
Speak.
Oh, speak.
Oh. I'm sorry.
I think I've seen this film at least once or twice a year for the last 30 years. And I'm always interested whenever I see it in other people's opinions. But I found that I tend to concentrate on particular scenes. For me, the central scene in the whole film was when Kirk Douglas goes to report to Adolph Manjou to tell about what George McCready had done and fired on his own soldiers. And it's done in a large room adjacent to where Adolph Manjou is having a party. And when Adolph Manjou comes out, and you can hear the light goes on and the music is playing, and Adolph Manjou says, well, what are you doing here? I have guests. We're having dinner. What are you bothering me for? And then as the scene progresses, it occurs to Adolph Manjou that Kirk Douglas is serious. And Adolph Manjou is astonished. He says, you mean to tell me that you actually are serious? You don't want his job? I thought you wanted his job. Well, you're a village idiot. Get out of here. I have to go back to my guests. And I thought that was a wonderful political analogy of the soldiers, the people who are in the trenches, the leaders, and then the politicians. And I thought that the melding of the politicians finally showing up, getting against the soldier, was a beautiful, beautiful denouement.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you brought up that scene. That really, I think you're right. That scene kind of brings to light what was something that Stanley Kubrick was so interested in, which was the place where having principles and living in a mad world collide. Because in his movies, over and over again, people claim to have principles. They claim to have, you know, intelligence or, you know, some sort of belief that guides them. And they enter these worlds where it's just, there's madness everywhere. And they have to kind of, navigate. And more often than not, his characters prove to be just as weak as everybody else. In this particular case, Kirk Douglas, you know, really retains his integrity, but at what cost? And that really, that scene kind of brings it together in such a clear way.
Ollie.
Yeah, actually, what your comment there, Hannah, reminded me of the first scene where the sort of really villainous guy with the scar, it talks about the troops at first and how ragged they are and it'll never work. And then in a dime, you know, he's manipulated so easily. So, but there's so much to talk about, but I'll just limit it to, I guess, two things. One is, it's unbelievable how short this movie is, considering how much goes on in it. And so we're like dropped in the middle of scenes and sort of key things you think you're gonna hear about and see, you don't see. But it all still works. And there's that like crazy staging in that first scene where they're walking around in a circle. And yeah, but it all is just brilliant. And even though it is so short, I think that really makes that end part where he lingers on all the faces of the soldiers and takes the time for this song to play out, like that's really slow, yeah. But beautiful in contrast to how quick everything else moves. Yeah. And also I just wanted to mention this soundtrack, the musical soundtrack, because I think it's mostly percussion.
Yeah.
Although I did notice at the very end, there seemed to be like a Hollywood, I don't know if the right word is sting or whatever, but the end, there was this flourish suddenly. I thought maybe if you would be able to comment whether that was added on or something, but yeah. But otherwise I thought the music was very powerful, just to have it be the drums mostly. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, your point about the pacing too, I think is so, drives home the point that like they get the orders to take the anthill and it has to happen like tomorrow, and so the pace, you know, it feels like the plot of the movie kind of merits this fast pacing, because it's just so, the, you know, they have to go into battle the next day and it has to happen. And then they have to deal with the insubordination immediately. And then there is, it really does make that last moment where they're all listening to the song and they're having this moment of shared humanity. Just like, it packs such a punch to let it like breathe almost at the end there, before they all have to, of course, go back to the trenches. In terms of the music, I mentioned that they had to do this whole movie on a very small budget. So a lot of the people who were involved actually were in Germany, because that's where they were sent to go make this movie. So a lot of the behind the scenes people were not established Hollywood, you know, composers or whatnot. They were established in Germany. So the composer on this movie was a German composer. And that music absolutely is very much, you know, the military drum is the key theme throughout. And it opens almost like a newsreel with the narration with the drums. So if you watch the very first moment, there is narration about this, you know, the men in the trenches, and for, you know, every day they were fighting for only a couple of yards. And incidentally, the person who narrated it is the man who was the judge of the court martial. It was the same actor who did that narration. But yeah, that was very much Stanley Kubrick was emphasizing kind of the drums, and then in other scenes, just the natural sounds of the war. So the soundtrack is kind of a mix of those two things. I'm not sure about that very last moment with the more Hollywood flourish, but that probably was, you know, not tacked on at the end. It was probably part of it.
Risa.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
So first, I want to thank you very much for selecting a movie in which I can care about the death of characters. I've been wanting that. And, you know, in contrast, you know, we live in a world now where we see death and war on television all the time. And what was, what from this movie, we saw people, you know, splattered on the battlefield in the beginning of the film. But when as with the current war in Ukraine, and when we see personal stories on the news, or you get to know someone, or you have much more of the visual where you see, you know, the crying women and children and all that, you get more of a sense of connection to what this horror and this loss really is. And I think what was so interesting about this film is that what was so horrific was not the bodies on the battlefield, but was the psychological immorality and the relationships and the conniving and the that was what was brutal about it. This film, I loved this film, and it's a film that I like the other gentleman, I probably could watch every year and still not really understand it all or take it all in, because it's short, but it's so complex in so many ways. And when I finished the film, I thought, this is a film that would probably people wrote dissertations about, because there's so much to say about it. But thank you for selecting this one.
No, thank you. That's such a good point about the juxtaposition of the deaths on the battlefield and then the deaths once we get to know these characters. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they died and we didn't, you know, you're watching them and you're like hoping that they're not going to die. You know, it was very painful. Yeah, but just the immorality and the meanness and all that was much more painful even than, you know, than the deaths in some ways.
Yeah. I see a lot of hands. I want to make sure we have time for everybody. Yeah.
John?
Yeah, I totally agree with that, you know, how immediate it is and how emotional it is and how raw it is in doing that. And I also like their conversation earlier about, you know, the principle, people feel like they have, generals feel that they have principles and things. And I like the way the script brings it to, they justify what they're doing in terms of not military strategy per se, but the fact that the war is dragging on and they need to show results, and their politicians and their papers, which are demanding results. And so in a way, they're forced into taking these actions that, you know, they wouldn't necessarily take from a military point of view, but feel that it's necessary from a political point of view. And I also liked, you did such a great job introducing this film, as always, too, Hannah. I really liked all the background. And I also liked the comments previously that people have made about filmmaking that Lawrence and Janet and Polly made. Those trench shots, tracking shots, I can't believe those weren't done with a Steadicam. They're so fluid and interesting. And then the court-martial scenes are so fluid, and the camera is so, which Kubrick always has. Kubrick is such a master filmmaker from a technical point of view. But just one final comment, the thing that I think this movie and a lot of his early movies have are really spontaneous acting. And I think I like the first half of his career a lot, because obviously that technical control led him to be a perfectionist and wanting to have control over everything. And there were some things that I read about this film that said that he already was doing a lot of takes.
Yes.
But it was obviously sort of under control, such that the acting still seemed really good. Whereas I think in the second half of his career, especially with a film like The Shining, where he did like 250 takes of scenes, the acting is so drained. Whereas I think this, we're all responding to the emotional immediacy of all the acting was done really well.
Absolutely. Yeah, these are all such good points. And something that you brought up about the outlook on morale and the French media and all this, I forgot to mention that the movie was banned in France for almost 20 years. The French government saw it as a total insult against the military in France. So people in France couldn't see this movie until the 1970s, which I think is also a testament to kind of the message that it's sending.
Right, and there was also the comment of, you know, shooting a few soldiers is good for morale. And then after the trial, after the shooting, you go to the scene in which the soldiers are all having a good time and laughing and drinking. And it's like, yeah, well, maybe that's true.
Right, yeah.
Thomas.
Couple of things. First of all, the war scene and the trenches, and then the whatever you call them, where they're down in the trench, and then they go up over the trenches, right. And all that land that they must have spent hours and hours moving that land around to make it look like that. I've never seen very many World War One movies, but to me, it really depicted in my mind what it must have really been like. I think they did a really good job on that. The other thing, though, is Kirk Douglas as Dax. I was disappointed as I was watching the movie. I just did not feel that Kirk Douglas was coming through. Mm. I mean, the reason is he was playing a role, and he played it well, of being the absurd follower of the absurdity of war. And for the most, except when he has that outlash of anger against Brouard, I think is his name. That's the only time that he really, you know, his real character of against the war comes out. But another thing that struck me is at the beginning of your presentation, you mentioned that Gregory Peck might have been Kirk Douglas's role. And it brought to mind 12 O'Clock High. Gregory Peck in 12 O'Clock High really exudes the internal struggle that he's going through to be in war, but does war based on principle that this is what you got to do in order to do it. And the reasons he's doing it are really pretty good. Whereas in this film, the reasons for attacking that objective on the other side of the was absurd. I mean, it was just throwing people against it to try and get that objective just was not very, very, very smart. So there's just a juxtaposition as to how I would have seen Gregory Peck in that role versus Kirk Douglas. Would there have been more of the internal strife that he is so good at doing? I mean, like in To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, he's that all that internal strife that he's able to exude really comes through. I did not see that in the Kirk Douglas character.
Absolutely. I mean, Gregory Peck made a career out of playing the man with integrity in a in all kinds of terrible situations, and how he was able to always be kind of dignified in that. Kirk Douglas really made a career out of being, I don't like to use the word histrionic, but that was how Kirk Douglas often presented himself, was being very, over the top, kind of aggressive in his reactions to things. And I think that this movie is often held up actually as one of his best performances because it's so toned down. Except in these later moments where he gets to kind of like let it out. But he is much more controlled. I agree with you that is a different, it's be interesting to see this movie with Gregory Peck in it too. Think about how he would have handled it differently. But that's a great point that I think, you think about the characters early on in the movie who are given commands and they're just doing it. And we haven't talked about Roger, the drunk commander who sends his men out and then deserts them and then decides to go against the one who's caught him doing the wrong thing. I mean, there's blackmail in this, in this dynamic too. And how I guess they're all totally, totally fatigued at the beginning to the point where any command they just have to do and there's not even time to think about it. But yeah, it's a great point that he seems to be a man with principles. Maybe he could have, stood up a little bit more. We're coming up on the hour, but I see a lot of great points coming in, including about the anthill being, the perfect metaphor for just the absurdity of it. Were there any last questions or comments that people wanted to get in there? We could easily talk about this movie for another hour, but I want to respect everyone's time.
Remy?
Yeah, you'd mentioned something about how Kirk Douglas's character is the only one that has integrity, like really maintains his integrity throughout the whole movie, but he ultimately isn't able to do anything about what he wants to be doing. So the futility of that and there's so much absurdity around him, and it's so, the pace of the movie felt very, it was hard to catch your breath throughout it. And even though he was, very, he was fighting for what the audience also sees as the right thing to do, there wasn't like his speech, which is barely a speech in the court martial, is very, you know, short and very frustratingly, you know, truncated. Like, he's not able to actually get anything done, and that just adds to like the whole overall anxiety of the movie, I think, when you're watching it, because it feels very much like even if somebody, one person shows up in this crazy world where everything's going wrong, there's not much that anyone can do about it. And it's just, the pace just continues until that last moment, that's that slow song, which kind of gives you whiplash, and then the movie ends. So which it's, I just found it a very fascinating, like, you know, little study in pacing in general, what this movie was like. And even though there was some, the message was, you know, to me at least, was that even if there, you know, it was obviously very like anti-war, very the futility of life. But it was super depressing because there's a lot of, you know, even if there's somebody who tries to stand up and do the right thing, the wave and the pacing is going to get to you no matter what.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you brought up about him not getting to make his speech in the courtroom too, because he doesn't get a chance to do anything that he wants. You're exactly right. This is, you know, such a frustrated character throughout. I would say, I think Thomas mentioned that other World War One movies, the other one that is a landmark movie is the 1930 adaptation of All Quiet on the Western Front, directed by Lewis Milestone, which if you haven't seen it, that's another really, really powerful, much earlier anti-war movie about World War One. And I was doing the math, and it's kind of interesting how that one came out the same number of years after World War One ended as this one came out the same number of years after World War Two ended. So it's kind of like, what does that say about when movie makers were ready to kind of tackle an anti-war theme with regard to how far in the past war had happened? But anyhow, I am so grateful for all of your incredible insights and questions about this movie. And I hope that if you liked it, maybe you'll pass it along to other people, because I think it's one that even non-classic movie fans might really appreciate and open their eyes to some great movies from the past. And speaking of which, next month, I hope you'll join us for Footlight Parade, something totally different from 1933, and some wonderful choreography that will dazzle the eyes and the mind. But thank you all so much for joining. For those of you who are just joining for the first time, I hope you'll join us again. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Hannah. And I hope to see you all again next month with Hannah for Footlight Parade. Have a great night, everybody.
Have a great night, guys.